This week on Our Beer Could Be Your Life, we sat down with Joe Lally. Joe Lally is the bass player for Fugazi, Mastetics, Corky, among many other projects, including many solo projects. Joe is a guy I met through taking bass lessons from him, something he's had to kind of pivot to during this past year of no playing. How are you guys doing today?
Doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good.
I'm good.
Good. That's good to hear. What are you guys drinking?
I'm drinking a Tom Swamp Road multigrain stout by Honest Weight. Our buddies, what's it? Orange, Massachusetts.
Orange. That's right. Central Mass. What is up?
Nice. What you got, Joe?
I am drinking The Future is Unwritten by Small Change, I think. Oh my God. I got to look at the name of the brewery. So I'm not looking at the can. I'm drinking out of a glass like a classy dude. It is an English mild, and it is in fact a callback to our first or second episode where we talked English milds and breweries that can sell English milds. I bought this today from my friends at Craft Beer Cellar. They had English milds in the cooler door. How about that? Buy the four pack. I bought one. Nice. The future isn't written. I was trying to figure out if that is a Joe Strummer quote or something about Joe Strummer, because that is the name of the Joe Strummer documentary that came out years ago, which is appropriate because it's a famous Joe and one of the other musicians that I hold in really high regard, like Mr. Joe Lally, who we talked to this week.
We got to Joe cubed. Nice.
That's right. We are Joe cubing it. How about you, Dennis? What you got in that glass?
All right. So I'm drinking a Tai Bay. It's a Palestinian IPA.
Oh, this is another callback.
Yeah. Our good friend Sammer turned me on to it. And I felt like with everything going on in the Middle East right now, it would be a good time to support a, you know, Arabic Palestinian brewery. And so I went up to Blanchard's in West Roxbury today, picked up a six pack of their IPA, and it's really freaking good. It's more of a closer to like a West Coast style IPA. It's a little piney, a little resinous, and I really like it. It's good.
Cool.
Definitely have to check that out.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about this episode was being able to just kind of pick Joe's brain about like just kind of at how he approaches music and the community around it. I tried really hard to bring it as much back to beer as possible, but Joe is not a big beer guy. Drank a lot of beer in his youth. Was a vehicle for getting fucked up. I think that's close to a direct quote from Joe. And then when it wasn't a part of life anymore, he just kind of like left it behind. Just, you know, occasionally had wine when he lived in Italy for a while and enjoyed Guinness when they were in Ireland. But, you know, Fugazi is like kind of famous for coming out of the straight edge hardcore scene, of which Minor Threat also comes up a bunch in this episode. And so I interacted with that as a kid as like rules for being an outsider. It's like not drinking alcohol was one of the, like, I don't know, the planks of that platform. And then I outgrew platforms and labels like a lot of people did. Like, I think maybe some of the people who made that music did, which we talked about.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. He, you know, joined what is a very famous person for hardcore, which is Ian MacKay. And then like, he wasn't part of that. It's just like, I, you know, he wasn't associated with that stuff, but I feel like, especially in the early days, they probably, everybody assumed they were. And so there was probably a lot of backlash. He even talks about like, you know, people calling out Ian for like saying that he drank a beer once.
Yeah, so which is pretty pretty ridiculous. And
what a ridiculous thing to defend, even regardless of whether he did or didn't, like, he didn't have a beer.
There's one of my favorite pieces of crowd banter in the Fugazi canon happens in the Instrument movie. In the Instrument movie, they have Guy standing on stage pointing at a guy who presumably is like fighting in the crowd or being a tough guy. And he's just like, you motherfucker right there. You're all tough and shit now. I saw you earlier eating ice cream. You're an ice cream eating motherfucker. And it just like goes on for like a couple of minutes. So they're just like roasting this guy. And then that movie is I don't know. I really like that movie. It really deals with process a lot, which is something that Joe deals with a lot as a bass player and like as a composer. I wanted to talk more about this, but our time was kind of limited. And he has helped me. I mentioned he gives bass lessons. He is really into process and understanding where you're going with an idea and also unpacking all of the extra layers that are on your idea, because I would go to him with all these like riffs and things that were super complicated and realize like, oh, all the ideas for like a much longer song are like packed on top of each other in this one little idea. And really you have the ideas for an entire song. You just have to like stop and slow it down and think about it from a different perspective. And I think that you could look at beer in a similar light when it comes to like, I don't know what I'm drinking, a 3% dark beer. Like you got to get all your elements right to make a beer like that taste good. This beer tastes good. You can't just half-ass out on any facet of this beer and expect it to be something that could earn a shelf or a cooler spot at a store like Craft Beer Sellers, which it does. So that's the elegant point that I don't make in the episode that I was trying to make.
Hey, you can make it now. That's fine.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to see Fugazi live?
I did not. I have a very specific memory of the opportunity that I had.
Me too.
And having missed it. You first. What is your opportunity?
When I was working at Tufts Catering, I knew the person that was like helping put on the show that was happening at Mass Art, which one of my favorite writers ever in a contract. It obviously wasn't a contract, but when it was the last Fugazi tour, I think, when they were coming to town, they had the request of like normal, like food and drink, and then access to a washer and dryer, because they're like, it's the middle of the tour. All we're going to want to do is be able to wash our clothes. So that was the one interesting rider that I remember in there, like, we'll come and play Mass Art as long as this happens. So I was working, and basically we did the stupid thing of drawing straws, and we're just like, we have two of you have to stay back, the rest of you can leave. And I got screwed, and I was one of the two people that didn't get to go. So that was my almost getting to see Fugazi story.
They were legendarily almost seen by so many people.
They were legendarily awesome that night, I assume.
That show is available in the Fugazi Live Discography series. So you can actually, as a plug for something that Joe's involved in, you can go to the Discord website and pick that show, and they will send you either a MP3 of it, or if you're a collector, you can have a CD of it if you like. But
famous last words of like, they'll be back. It's okay.
Go see that show now, guys. Before they'll be back, quote unquote.
That's a good point. Any show could be the last show. And coincidentally, Fugazi has never broken up. Fugazi is all the projects I mentioned that Joe are involved in, they all intersect with various people who are in Fugazi, and they are also friends. They are just at that weird state where they are way too large to come back and play an auditorium at Mass Art or whatever venue that was in 1997. They definitely don't want to play stadiums. They probably can't play stadiums, right? I don't know. Maybe they'd be like a headliner for a festival weekend.
Don't think they would. Like, I think no. They would rather play the Mass Art Auditorium like three nights.
Yeah. But do they want to do that? They would have to do it for they have to be a fucking residency anywhere they went. It would just have to be a whole thing. And they all have families and responsibilities. And when Joe talks about it, he's like, what's the point? Like, he says it in the episode, and this comes up with him frequently. He has to relearn Fugazi songs because it's been a long fucking time. And he's like, I don't play this shit anymore. But like, all right, you want to like learn end hits? Like, I got to go back and like listen to it and like tab it out.
So Joe, when you started taking bass lessons from him, were you starstruck or a little? Because I know Fugazi's your favorite band.
Yeah, I was really nervous, and I think this is his first time teaching, and I haven't gotten lessons since I was a kid, and even then it wasn't very long. And I know that people have conflicting experiences and thoughts about lesson taking in general, but for me, it was really helpful to have the accountability of having to like get on a Skype with like my, not only like are they one of my favorite bands? Like, his bass playing in particular has always been something I've always really loved. Like, just the rhythm of them, the kind of counter melody to the guitars, they like anchor this band along with the drums, where both guitars can just careen off course at any point in time and then come back to Joe and Brendan like locked together. So all that shit, right? But like the fact that I had to talk to him with a bass in my hand every 2 weeks, and I still do it, and it's still fun, and we talk about music theory and what he's learned as being a teacher. But like when I showed up just for the accountability, I was like, oh, I didn't show up with any questions, or like I just like talked about how like I haven't played in like such a long time. And you know,
you were like, you're my favorite bass player ever.
Yeah, just for the entire time.
Yeah.
Can you teach me Waiting Room?
But I think that's what he was expecting. And I'm sure that's what he gets some people to do, is just like, yeah, you know, come on, want to play Waiting Room. And yeah, you know, that line is not that hard to learn. It's not that complicated.
No, there's plenty of guys on YouTube that can show you that bass line. It's very simple.
Yeah, but there was something about him that I found engaging, and like the fact that he's learning about being a teacher while teaching, and was honest about that, and it's just interesting to me enough to keep me going and enough to keep me from like freaking out about it. It's just like, listen, I'm going to talk to this dude, I'm going to make the most of my time, and it's going to keep me playing week to week. And at the beginning, it was keeping me playing, and now I've just been playing because I like playing, which is even better.
Nice. Well, I listened to that Soft Pants song you guys released on Bandcamp, and I thought the bass line was sick.
Well, thanks, man.
Yeah.
I like that bass line. We were talking about where all that came from, and I'm not really sure that I wrote it, but I don't know. Hey, we wrote it together. And
you played it.
I played it. That's true. So that counts.
I don't know where it came from, and I think I wrote it, so.
Yeah. This is just like, you know, the whole beginning of the breakdown in the band right here is just the like the attribution of one bass line. Just to plant the seed that will someday break up this band.
Joe's big head. Yeah. This band is the bass lines.
They don't call it bass driven guitar rock for nothing. Bass comes first. That's right.
We are getting way off track here.
Are we though? That's true. This is just, you know, as they say, fix it in post.
This is now a bass only podcast.
Yeah, why not?
Only bass players.
I mean, you and I'd be just fine. You guys are playing your counter Simpsons episode. I can get my own thing going with you, Dennis. We just need another bass player. You, me, and Joe Lally will start our own podcast.
Understood.
This being an audio medium, you missed the dramatic exit of one Matthew Azelius. It was good.
Dramatically turning his camera off in protest.
We're going to need a creaky door sound drop for that moment right there.
That I can do.
Well, hey, enjoy minimal talk about beer. Shoehorning that tries to bring beer back up several times. And a little bit of beer talk with the great and gracious Joe Lally.
Yeah, get ready for some serious opinions on Cheap Trick.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good.
Yeah, we're having a nice little Saturday. We had a field day with our brewery team yesterday. So for the first time in over a year, we got all of our sales and marketing people together, walked around the lake, hung out outside, and everybody's vaccinated. And it was just I'm still feeling the lift from that. It was really nice to be able to be with human beings in person.
It is a new and different experience today. Yes,
sure is. And you know, I don't know how social you were before this past year. For me personally, I didn't know how much I relied on contact with other people until I couldn't have it for a year. And here we are.
Unfortunately, I seem to do just fine hanging out in my room, which worries me a little bit. But I miss being able to go out and play. And that's, I guess, when I usually get to socialize, or if I'm going to see someone play. And I don't know how much I manage beyond that. So yeah, it's true. I've lost most of my socializing. Although, weekend before last, there were shows on people's front porches and in front of a store in this one neighborhood, Petworth in DC. And I got to see a band play a set, I think for the first time in like a year.
How was that?
It was pretty amazing getting to watch someone play. But I have to say, because I have seen like 10,000 shows at this point in my life, I seriously couldn't remember whether I had seen another show over the last year. Had it really been a year? I could not make up my mind.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm damaged.
I think we're all damaged after the last year.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of nice. I mean, my ears probably could have used the break, but yeah. It's been nice having the break. I miss seeing bands, and I will go see them as soon as I get a chance.
Yeah, what's the status of DC when it comes to clubs being open and allowing music? Is that happening yet?
Well, there's like the first announcements for the bigger things. You know, the arena has something booked, and like the Anthem has 6,000 people, and they're starting to announce a thing or two for the summer. And you know, there's like some of those things that were canceled last summer, you know, like Rod Stewart and Cheap Trick. I noticed that's like on its way back.
Are your tickets still good for that show?
I can only hope so. Yeah. I will go see Cheap Trick, except that I know that Ian can get us in. So I seriously would go see them any chance I got. They were kind of one of the last things. Within the last month of seeing shows, that was one of the last things I saw. They played the Warner Theater here.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and they had Rick's son is playing drums, and Robin's son was playing guitar and doing backing vocals. And he actually has a great voice, and it was totally crazy. But they're a great band.
That's I support that. Cheap Trick's great. There's a hook machine band right there. Oh. Just hook after hook.
Yeah. They're an excellent band and really nice guys, I have to say. They didn't have to spend 2 seconds looking at us, but ever since the first time we met them, they're so fucking nice. I was like, oh my God, why are they being so nice? This is insane.
That's always a plus. I always like it when bands are just nice. They don't have to be, but they just are.
Exactly. The first, we went to see Joan Jett play at, what is it called? I want to say that it was at Wolf Trap. I have honestly no idea where it was now. We're outside somewhere and it wasn't Wolf Trap. It was somewhere else. Oh, it was out in Virginia at some amphitheater type thing. And, we were talking to Joan cause we know Joan. I actually grew up, a couple of blocks from where she lived when she went to through her high school years. I don't know if she lived somewhere before that, but we lived in Rockville, Maryland in the same, within two blocks of each other. And I didn't know her then because I was however much younger than her that I am, four or five years or something. She's in my sister's yearbook for high school. So anyway, over the years, she invited Fugazi to a show, and she's always really, she's a big Fugazi fan. She's really sweet and very nice to us. And so we went to see her when I first moved back from Italy. So it was 2015, and Cheap Trick and Heart and Joan Jett are playing together. So we come out of her trailer where mostly she was actually secretly just listening to the baseball game while we talked with her manager, Kenny. She was trying to be nice and pay attention to us, but she was like pretty into the Orioles game because she loves the Orioles. And we go out of the trailer and go, and Cheap Trick is playing. They're doing their sound check. And we're going towards the back of the stage and realize they're playing Helter Skelter. And it sounds fucking awesome. It sounded so fucking good. They're destroying it, right? Killing it. And we come up on the stage and they're just kind of like, it's like nothing. They're just kind of wandering around playing this fucking song amazingly. And then Rick puts down his guitar and just comes over to Ian and is just like, hey, you're the waiting room guy or whatever. He just said some fucking crazy ass shit. They all walk over and they're like right on top of us. They're so close that I went to shake Robin's hand and he couldn't see me trying to shake his hand because my hand was under his face, was right in front of him. I was like, why are these guys so nice? It was pretty awesome. I had been living in Italy for 8 years and I hadn't done anything like remotely like that in like 10 years. And then all of a sudden I was there. It was kind of the most amazing show I've ever been to on some levels.
There's like a level of popularity that those bands that you're talking about that show have in society. Do you think that like Fugazi carries that level of fandom within the working musician world, and that's part of how that works?
I can't grasp that, if that were true at all. It doesn't make sense to me. But the woman who was doing, a woman who was a like road manager for Heart, knew who we were and had been to shows of ours. And then, I mean, they came out of their dressing room once and we're right, you know, we're all right there in the hallway together. And there's like Ann and Nancy Wilson. And they're like, hey, how's it going? Like, what? So how come we don't like see each other more or know each other better or something? And I was like, because you were a rock star when I was in junior high school? like, what are we even talking about? Like, I just didn't even, the question just went like over my head. Like, did somebody say that? Like, what the fuck is going on? I was so discombobulated. Like, that whole event was just so out of the ordinary for me. But it turned out that Cameron Crowe is married to the guitar player.
And
they had come to a Fugazi show in LA like, you know, 80 years before that. And which, you know, I didn't know that they were there, or I don't know if anyone else knew that they had been there or whatever, but they were fans because apparently Cameron Crowe's a fan. And it was just so weird having them just talking to us. And, you know, it wasn't long. And actually, I didn't even get to see their set. It was, you know, I don't know. We had to, you know, my daughter had school the next day or some nonsense. And it was, you know, you're like, but wait a minute, I'm having the greatest time of my life. But it really, it's funny. It was mind boggling. Anyway.
Your daughter should learn early that school is nonsense. That is definitely the message that we got to come away from this from.
Believe me, I'm not the kind of parent that says the right thing 90% of the time. I'm like, you know, when something's wrong at school, I'm like, that's because school is fucked up, dear. You know, and I was like, that's because that sucks, honey. It really, yeah, I don't have any good, anything good to say about school. She does well, which is probably why she does well in school.
As someone with a daughter on the way, I feel like I'm going to be in the same boat. I'm going to be like, you know, some homework question. I'm like, homework is bullshit. Shouldn't be doing it anyways.
The worse attitude we have about it, the more they think it's important. So,
perfect. That works out.
Reverse psychology right out the gate.
George Harrison used to say to his son, like, why don't you just drop school this week and let's go boating in the Pacific? Or, you know, he would just have some totally out there thing that they could do. And Donnie would be like, Dad, like, I have school. Like, the only thing I could do to rebel in my family, he would say, you know, was to like go to school.
Right. you know, it's like managing upwards as this generation, I guess. Is your daughter a musician as well?
She played piano when she was very young, but I knew that I couldn't do much with that. You know, I couldn't bring any of my bullshit, you know, desires about it. And so I didn't force her to be a jazz drummer, which is what I would have done. Honey, I know.
It'd be really handy to be living with a jazz drummer.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you should have forced her to play piano and then she would have wanted to play the drums. I mean,
at five, I should have said, I know you're only five, but listen, jazz drum lessons start tomorrow and things, we've got some shit to do here. So get to work. But I didn't do that. I should have.
So this is, I guess, ostensibly a beer podcast that Matt and I.
That's what I've been told, but yeah, I don't know if I've, the most, you know, the beer drinking I did, it all ended by the time I was 22 or something.
Sure.
I did all that, you know, Mickey's Big Mouth and Budweiser.
Mickey's Big Mouth.
Budweiser, nice. Whatever was cheap, which made me have no affiliation with beer whatsoever because it all tasted shitty. And I understood that it tasted shitty and that kind of thing. But I did start to pay attention when we lived in Rome and I got to know, you know, I don't even know how to say this German beer called Paulaner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to say that. Paulaner is what they would say in Italy. And you know, I actually, I'm blanking on the one beer I would try in Italy, their beer, Peroni. Peroni now and again. But I would have a beer, you know. But I like Guinness actually for a beer to have. I like Guinness very cold.
Yeah, we talked about that briefly. Did you mention that you had visited the brewery, or did you just have it served proper?
We never got to do that. And of course, that was no one's, you know, there wasn't a big enough consensus in Fugazi to like go to a brewery. Ian and Guy, you know, real interest in that. And I guess I would have, because I made it a point to at least, you know, taste one and like drink one when Fugazi was there, I think one time, literally one time. And and it was just like, oh my God, they're insane when you're there. It's so different. And you can't bottle that and send it out and expect it to stay the same. But my God, it was so different and interesting. And I remember going into some pub with like Joey P and Jerry, because they would have one. And it was so like you were in a Led Zeppelin cover. Like, you know, some shot from a Zeppelin photo. And it just was like so working class Ireland. Everyone's just kind of sitting around looking at the newspaper or whatever, and of every age and, you know, young working woman and then a middle class man and then an older woman, all these people just together. And that's what they did. And then they went on and, you know, just had a beer and then they went on and did whatever they were doing. But it was just it's just such a different atmosphere. Apparently Europe is different than the United States.
So they say.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the origins of the word pub as a public house, a place where everybody can go and find some community. And I think, you know, ostensibly when we say it, this is ostensibly a beer podcast, we try to look, you know, talk to people either over a beer or through the lens of what we do and about that. But I think, you know, how we engage with beer is like, you know, something that connects us with other people. And, you know, in a different version and idea of this podcast, we'd be sitting in our brewery. You in Mesthetics would be in town for a show and you'd stop by our place and have a beer with us. And we would have this conversation over it and try to link the things together.
Right. That is nice. That's, the social thing indeed.
But I think I know I'm actually wearing a shirt that rips off a Minor Threat thing on the back of it. It says Minor Brett and it has the brewers of this beer emulating Ian on the steps with an Orval in the corner, which is a famous Trappist beer that uses Brettanomyces yeast. So it's like a cross-section deep pun for a very specific subset of people who are like into geeky beer and also grew up listening to hardcore. in straight edge
hardware. That is totally amazing. That's crazy.
It is. And I wore it today thinking of you, but it's like, but it's on my back. So we're in, and we're in an audio medium. So we're really not going to be getting the full effect of that today.
Two for two.
That reminds me of a, I swear I saw a post go by on Instagram the other day that was like, someone had posted something about Ian talking about caffeine. Like there was this discussion about tea and coffee. And I don't really understand what it was. I didn't open it up. But underneath it was just the one comment by a guy who said, I saw Ian drinking a, and then it was literally like some drink, like a mixed drink or a, you know, a beer in whatever city and what year, you know, some bullshit. And I just stood there like next to the keys to type. And I'm like, and I let it go.
Letting it go is definitely the route.
You when can't go there, man. But there's people who insist. No. People who are like, they weren't even old enough to see Ian doing whatever it was they said, you know, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
At the time that they swear. It's just bizarre. But anyway, that's a nice, at least it's nicely done. It's that in which you refer.
But it got me thinking about one of the things I read. I don't remember if you said this to me or I read this, but you talked about like how you picked up the bass after seeing Minor Threat perform. And so, you know, you're kind of steeped in this scene that as I grew up in Boston, outside of it, this was like straight edge hardcore. Like that's what that was. And so, you know, I don't know how real or perceived the dogma was at the time, but it does seem like alcohol and that scene are linked, but in an opposite relationship. Like these people are rejecting that portion of it, at least, and certainly in some of the lyrics on Minor Threat. So I'm curious if that at the time felt like that was a movement or pushing something aside, or is it just the people who were doing that were like a different group of people that were trying to be, I don't know, violent or like, I guess I'm just kind of curious how it felt going through that.
It's well, I drank and took drugs at the time. I did. And that went on through discovering Minor Threat, seeing Minor Threat and like kind of, you know, moving on and listening to more bands or whatever after they broke up. They didn't have that effect on me because I was pretty, you know, adamant about just being fucked up. At the same time, I appreciated of the hardcore bands, it was clear to me that this was really well-written music. This is really good. And it was delivered well and everything. It wasn't a band visually for me that stood out that made me want to see it. I just knew that they were a good band, but you know, I just wanted to see something like The Obsessed or Ian's brother's band, The Faith. They were just, you know, they just looked dirtier, you know. It's just as, I don't know. It was just, I am who I am, you know. I may be a heap, but that's the way I looked at things. And it didn't make me think differently about it. I was not a DC person, so I was not in the middle of all those things happening. Just perceiving it from, you know, a suburban guy's view who came into the city to see shows as many as I could. And really what ended up being on my own because I couldn't get any of my friends to fucking go half the time. It was something that was going on between these people. Looking back at it after having been like in Fugazi and understanding a lot of what went on during that time. Again, I think it was the people who just, they just kind of quietly did that because they were like, well, that makes sense. Not to be totally fucked up and stupid, you know, that was about it. The people who made something of it, I saw people wearing like vintage, you know, shirts. They would like make their own shirt to just, and it was all silly to them because they were also people who were at every Minor Threat show, you know, that kind of thing. And that was like specifically like a skater, you know, at the time, a guy who was a big skater who I would go see. There was this ramp in Annandale and I would go see him skate there and other guys on this team. And they were called the Toke team. So of course they were going to have an attitude about that stuff. But it, you know, as social circles do, they all cross, you know, worlds with each other. It was almost probably more intense from the outside because of the way it swept up people to then become that only. And then they laid down what they believed was, you know, their version of where it began, the birth of it or something, you know? So then it all gets lost, because I never wanted to listen to any of those other bands that might have sounded like Minor Threat or sang specifically about. I just never, there was only so much room for hardcore, I think, in my head anyway. I enjoyed everything I was seeing, mainly because it was this local movement, you know, that you could go down and see all this stuff, you know. I didn't need to go out and try to pick up all these records from all over the country. There were interesting bands for sure, but I only knew like Black Flag, you know, the Bad Brains, Minor Threat, like those were the most amazing, you know, and the Minutemen. I really, beyond that, I didn't, most of them didn't stand up to that. Like later, it took a while for me to even learn about half of it, like the Big Boys, you know. I was kind of, even though I probably saw, I don't know if I actually saw that show. They played with Minor Threat in town. I might've seen a different one, but anyway, you know, I just didn't get it all, because I wasn't out buying at all and stuff like that. So it's just, there was definitely a huge part of that thing I actually also missed. I was just kind of taking it in the Dead Kennedys, you know, I'd be going to those shows. And so it was just kind of getting what I could, being an alien from, you know, 20 minutes north.
Sure.
Really, like
just interloping right into the scene, finding your way in.
I'm telling you, you know? it's so, like, if you could even find out about the show, it would have been a miracle, you know. So there's all kinds of shit I missed. And I missed Bad Brains didn't play a show in like 1979 or so in Madam's Organ, which was this group house. And I think Ian actually got up with this guy, Dave Byers, and they jammed with some other people that night. But because the Bad Brains did not show up and play, I didn't really understand what hardcore was as a movement or what the Bad Brains were really like. And it took me a while to see that. I only knew the single Pay to Come at the time. So I just missed an entire like couple of years of super important shows, because it was, I just had no clue they were going on. Anyway.
Yeah, I guess looking back, you know, you can say, you can use the capital I important, saying that, you know, everyone is going to say they're at this one place or this one show, right? But, you know, it sounds like of the 10,000 you've seen and been a part of, it's you've seen plenty.
Right.
I also feel like on the other side of it, I feel like probably 10,000 people said they were at that show and there was like, you know, 95.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I missed the Damned. They probably came numerous times to DC, and for some reason, I never fucking saw any of those shows. And some of those shows, the kids getting up in DC to jump off the stage were so pushed away by the Damned's like policy about that and the bouncers that they had, that the kids at the show pulled the bouncers into the audience. And it was just a huge fucking fight. And like that kind of shit, like those shows I missed and early Bad Brains show. By the time I was seeing the Bad Brains, they might have left DC. They might have been like living in New York then, you know.
Right.
So that was kind of weird.
This, you know, his history that has been documented and talked about, you know, I think growing up in Boston, you know, 20, 30 years after that, whatever it was, when I, you know, Straight Edge was this like dogmatic, violent kind of crew of people that were just like holding Ian to like things that he wrote when he was like 18 or 19 years old. I would hope that nobody would hold me to things that I wrote when I was 18 or 19 years old. I think it's pretty unfortunate looking back to think how much of that is like predicated on like this teenager from a different city years ago.
Totally.
Writing punk songs.
And people did, you know, people did make it very dogmatic and turned it into things, because they just, you know, people have time on their hands to do those things.
Nuance.
People also like to validate being dicks. So if they can find a reason to validate their being a fucking asshole, they'll find it.
That's true too, yes. That's a big part of it.
I'm curious because, you know, a lot of the stuff we just talked about, which, you know, is for, you know, for contextually for me, kind of ancient history and stuff that I've just read or obsessed about when I was a teenager, looking back years before. You've ended up, you know, you continue to collaborate with a lot of the same musicians that were dispersed in that scene when you were, you know, first discovering it. And you said, you know, just picking up a bass after a Minor Threat show, obviously you were in Fugazi with Ian, but then you also put out a record, Corky, last year, the year before, that is, I think, a culmination of a couple of years worth of collaboration. What is it like to collaborate across such a time? I don't know. How have you grown in your collaborative efforts with these folks? Is it different now than it was?
It is pretty weird. I mean, from the inside, it's like the obvious thing to do. It's like the only thing to do in a way, you know, like, well, God, I can play with musicians that I know very well. If I'm here in DC, DC is kind of an expensive place to live for me at this point. After having lived in Italy and come back, that, you know, that just made a mess of some parts of my life. So, you know, just being able to stay here was just like, whoa, this is not so easy. And at the same time, it's like, if I'm going to be making music with people, I would much rather be here making it with, you know, I'm a band like The Mesthetics with Brandon. Yes, I would love to do that. A band like Corky with Ian. Yes, I would love to do that. So it's kind of the fact that I'm playing with people I know. And, you know, so from the inside, it's like, well, of course I want to play with my friends. You know, it's just the way, but yes, the beginning of it is really weird that I was seeing these bands, but it was only, you know, an totally extreme move to drop what was an extremely secure job, you know, having a job with a government contractor for NASA, you know, from 82 to 86, and to quit that job. I mean, I was paid well. I could have found something that I could move forward with. They would have sent me to school for free, anything to do with computers, which I didn't take advantage of at all. They kept giving me incremental raises that kept me from just walking away at any point that I really, I don't like doing this, and I would have quit, but they just kept, they would give me a raise and I would go, okay, I'll just stay. And then you have all your benefits and health, dental. I mean, just, I quit that to be a roadie in 1986, get in a van with Beefeater and go across the United States for the first time in my life to see something that wasn't just going to my cousin's house on a vacation. You know, I had been to Illinois, to my cousin's house, which was, you know, Decatur, Illinois. So I was going to like cornfields. And then I was, I'd been to like around New York City, like New Jersey. I had uncles up there, you know, those like New City, and then around Orange, New York, and went to Maine once with my parents, because I'm the youngest. And that's like Virginia Beach, North Carolina, maybe once. I mean, I just hadn't been anywhere. I hadn't been on a plane. You know what I mean? But the first time I was on a plane was to go to England with Fugazi.
Wow.
I just had not, you know. So going around with Beefeater in 1986, I got to go into Canada. We went to Montreal and somewhere, I don't remember everywhere we went, but in above the northeast of the States, back in to the States and across the northern Midwest, and then skipping the Northeast and cutting down through California. And but like we played Fresno and we played Salt Lake City, I think. Man, yeah, it turns out I can't remember very well. So, but did make it, you know, down through, and then not the North, not the Southeast. So we kind of went through, you know, played Arizona and then back up, but missing. We went through Texas, but that was it. From that edge, we sort of went back more northern route.
Were you a bass player then?
I had picked up the bass 3 years before, so 83, and I tried making a couple of bands work with my friend that I said I would start a band with after that Minor Threat show, Peter Kortner, who went on to sing for Dag Nasty. And those were, you know, couple of bands literally play, both bands play two shows. You're going to listen to a dog bark now. Both those bands did that. And then not long after doing those two shows, each, the second show of the second band, whatever that means, sometime in 1984, I cut my hand at work to the bone. I cut my fingers to the bone. And then I couldn't play bass through most of 85. But by the end of 85, it was like trying to play bass again. And I was trying to see if I could play with, and I kept trying to jam with people or do things. It was just getting nowhere. And I even bought a drum set and was like, oh, I'll be a drummer instead. And I was trying to play drums with people. And just nothing was happening, that's all. Just like not, there's people I liked who are musicians, but I was not making anything work with them. And so like, it was a bigger step toward being in a band, it turned out, by being a roadie in a band. Because I was in that band. Even if my job was just setting up the drums almost exactly the way Kenny Cron, the drummer, liked his drums setting up, the fact that he could sit down and go like, man, that is really close to the way I like my drums. Like when I hit that point on the tour, I was just like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Like I could have possibly just been happy doing that for the rest of my life. I mean, if there was always a band that I loved that much that I could roadie for, I would have done it. You know what I mean? I liked it. I felt like a band member doing that shit. So it was, that meant a lot to me. And then just opened my mind about doing what I wanted to do. But, you know, part of that was seeing bands like Black Flag. It was something about, you know, lyrically, and so, you know, the things that stick with you about bands that you loved, that were that extreme feeling, just seeing them play, you're just like, this, you know, these guys are fucking out of their minds. You know, to find out later that they would literally go into a thrift store and buy clothes of various sizes, and everyone would use those clothes, and then those clothes would get washed, and then everyone would pick out of those clothes. So Greg might be wearing something that's way too tight for him, and Henry might be wearing something that's too big for him. That's fucking great.
I don't know. As we've talked about, like what the youth culture today has that's akin to this kind of thing, and it's tough because we're not youths to identify it.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of the cool thing about hardcore, even though the music never seemed to go too far in any particular direction. And I suppose it still does change because I'm not listening to it enough. As a genre, I just don't see it like breaking a bunch of glass ceilings. But again, I could be wrong. But they do take place. I would suddenly find out that in DC, there's this weird hardcore festival. It would happen every year in like a church basement or some place, you know, and it would happen 2 days in a row or then again the next weekend or whatever it is they do. And I'd just be like, that is fucking wild that happens today. Like, it's so cool that happens, you know. And I have no idea like where those people come from. Like, they're too, you know, so much older than them. Of course I don't know anything about it, but it's just so cool to know that that's going on. And it's obviously that goes on all over the place. That part of it is really cool because that means that there's a network that's always going on between cities, that people go around and meet each other and communicate to each other about what they, you know, believe and don't believe and what they want to make of the world, you know, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I went to see a band I really like, and they were opening for another band, and it was packed with, it was a all ages show, and it was just packed with kids. And it made me like, kind of be like, hey, I don't want you people around me, but I'm really glad that you're here and listening to like this punk band that I'd never heard of before, but like they're all there for that.
Right.
Which is very nice. It's good to see that scene just kind of keeps going.
Totally. Totally. It's surprising because it, you know, it gets put in such a place and time for us. And if you don't see it advertised, you know, or happening, like, oh, there are the, like every Saturday you pass some place and you go, oh, there's the punks going to their, you know, like if you don't see it like on a regular basis, you're kind of like, oh my God, right, that's still going on, you know, and someone, you know, will show up with a fucking amazing mohawk and you're like, yes.
Oh, the Elmer's glue propping it up just
makes you so happy. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked to one of Oz's good friends, Ryan, fairly recently. And Ryan does a lot of booking in Boston at this bar called O'Brien's. Or he recently handed the torch off to another friend of ours who's been on the pod. And we asked him directly about that, like where, you know, what the ecosystem is going to be like coming out of this past year we've had. And he was very confident that, you know, weird art will find its place. There will be weird art. There will always be.
Definitely. As long as there is some kind of a venue available, people are going to turn things into what they need to turn them into. I do wonder about like a bunch of the places in aesthetics played were the size of place that would have closed. And we heard about that in the first few months. And then I stopped hearing everything from everyone. So I have no idea how many places we would have played that don't even exist anymore. You know,
I mean, the place we saw you last at Great Scott up here was almost going to close. They are trying to move locations, but their place where you played is gone now.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, yeah, we're the perfect size for that. So I suppose it's just going to be. It's going to end up being the places that were mostly bars in the first place. Those will stay because bar is a bar. And if that, you know, can survive, it has a chance on its own. But a place that was, you know, I don't know, there's a place that was, it seems like it should have stayed, a bar, the Mothlight is that what it was called? In Asheville, North Carolina. But I think that place shut down and, you know, places like that, I just didn't think that would happen in, but I'm still such a long way off of the aesthetics doing anything that, you know, there's plenty of time for the places to rebuild. So
what are there any of your projects that are close to trying to play a show or people reach out to you at this
point? No, because the aesthetics haven't been together since May 3rd, 2020. And, Cricky is a band that actually just focuses on getting together a couple of times a week and writing. So we just keep doing that anyway. And we were going to play right as all this started last March. We were going to go like, let's try and do shows more often.
I remember the language on your Bandcamp, which is they hope to tour.
us hope. And didn't get any of that going. And so it's still, you know, but now because the focus is so much writing that we literally haven't practiced all the songs we do know because there was no option to play them live. We're a band that controls everything about the place that we play in. And you still can't play a show in a very tight space anyway without, you know, I mean, the places we were playing, you're 12, you know, a dozen people are probably allowed to watch us. So we're just not a band that's ready to play anyway, I guess. So. Yeah, nothing's happening right now. My solo music that tries to get around all this. Solo music is supposed to function by people going like, you want to improvise, right? And then it just requires me practicing. And I get two people who are happy to improvise. And then we all just make it happen. So if those venues present themselves, I'll probably play a solo show before I play anything else.
Probably the easiest thing to figure out at this point too.
Yeah, that you just need like a room and two people that are willing to set up shop with you, it seems like. So how hard could that be?
Right.
You could do that on your porch. You know, you saw another band do that. There's no reason. I don't know if you have a porch. I guess I'm being presumptive of your porch presence, but
my two bedroom apartment doesn't have a porch, oddly, or a balcony, but it's, you know, as soon as if they keep doing these shows, like these weird outdoor things that happen all over the place, if somebody really wants to do one, we can, you know, they've done that. And my Jerry Busher will play drums with me when I play in DC. And that's happened in his neighborhood. I think they played on his porch. They did some shows. So, anyway, that's always possible. So yeah, more than
that. So you were a, self-taught bassist. I was a self-taught home brewer. I wasn't very good. Oz, did you ever homebrew?
Yes, I did homebrew.
Similarly?
Similarly, yeah. Just, you know, right. Read a recipe in a book and made some bad beer.
Right. So, you know, over multiple years of iterations of you playing bass, you are now in a position where you teach bass lessons, which is how we met. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, well, first of all, I guess I'm curious if you started the bass lessons around the pandemic, or was that something before? And I'm also curious what you've learned by teaching.
I really did start giving lessons because I was like, I got to make sure I pay the rent. because I played live shows, which I couldn't do. And I worked at the box office, the Lincoln Theater, and there was nothing to do there anymore. So I was immediately out of all the work I had available to me. So that's why I started doing them. And I figured it out as I went along, but I also found that I really enjoyed wanting to pass on what I did know now that I knew how to talk about what I was doing, which I never knew how to do the entire time that I played in Fugazi. Really, I didn't have much technical jargon for anything in order to talk about music. So yeah, I started studying things about music after Fugazi stopped playing. And then that probably became more concentrated. I may have started looking into things more, especially after starting to play with Anthony, but I probably had already gotten into something. I just became asking more questions because I could with Anthony. I mean, he can answer all questions, you know.
And that's Anthony, the guitar player.
Anthony Pirog from the Mesthetics, because he is also a teacher. He's also a guitar teacher, but he studied music in school. So he really is like the source for me to be asking things of. So then when I did start to teach, I kind of would bounce things off him first and find out about things. And I kept picking up more things that I want to do. And I don't know about my students, but I'm learning a lot. I mean, really, it's totally crazy. It's like the more I have to explain something, the more I know about it, the deeper I go into it. And I just keep digging more things out of stuff I had no idea, you know? So I keep learning more, and it's actually leading me to want to know other things. And so I think I'm going to be teaching for quite some time just because I'm really enjoying it.
I can't speak. I've enjoyed the lessons, but you'd have to ask Matt Oz if I'm getting any better. you don't have to answer that.
That's a different podcast, Joe. I guess going back to, you know, you being self-taught, you know, bassist, what inspired you to pick up the bass? You seem like you were obviously very attracted to it.
Yeah, there's a history of the music I listened to probably was the main thing, because when Peter and I were like, we'll start a band, there was no other instrument for me that even crossed my mind. You know, even though I mostly hung out with, I had a close friend who was a drummer, you know, since I was in junior high school, and I would sit, you know, watching him play all the time, and then people coming over in the neighborhood who could play various songs, like mostly guitar players would come over, and then he played in a band. We were watching, you know, cover versions of Zeppelin stuff or, you know, Van Halen or something. But other than, you know, considering the drums, it was, yeah, an instrument was going to be bass, because once there was, you know, Joy Division and Public Image to listen to, man, that really hit me hard. But I was tying in what Ja Wobble and Peter Hook were doing. It made sense in my mind in relationship to all the R&B, soul, and funk I listened to since I was like 9, 10, 11, 12. I spent a good amount of time not only listening to, you know, the Ohio Players and James Brown, Otis Redding, Sly and the Family Stone, Graham Central Station. These are my like top bands, Earth, Wind and Fire and stuff.
That's some ambitious bass playing, yeah.
Listening. That was just listening. You know what I mean? But this is 11 years old, and I'm seeing the Isley Brothers, the Jackson 5, the OJs, the Spinners. I was seeing those bands because they did afternoon shows. and my next door neighbor, my best friend, he had older brothers, and they would just take us with them, and we'd see that. So I didn't see the bands that would be playing at night, like the Ohio Players. I never got to see kind of the better things that you'd be seeing at nighttime shows. But anyway, that, you know, there was a big stretch between when I saw, when I picked up an instrument. So I went through classic rock after that, and then, and that was pretty quick. So I was ready for punk rock by the time, you know, a couple of years with classic rock, I was like, this isn't getting me anywhere, man. Fuck the Eagles, you know? And, that I was ready for it. And then punk rock embraced so many different types of music that it was kind of mind boggling. So I was super influenced to pick up an instrument because of hearing bands like the Cramps, although they were, you know, like gods, and a band like Pink Section, you know, they just sounded like they were just figuring it out as they were recording, and it was awesome. And there were just so many different types of bands, but then I could see how the bass was used when I was listening to Joy Division and Public Image. And there was something I was tying in. I wouldn't have been able to explain this on paper, but I could really like see the thread that connected that to early R&B and dub, you know, which connected with R&B and in ways. And then there were all these things that made sense to me about repetition. That wasn't always the repetition I imagined it to be. I put the bass in a place and could see how it would be utilized in a band. And I set out to do that basically. And learned how to play bass along the way by writing with people. I never could figure out people's songs on the records. In about 3 minutes, I'm sorry.
It's okay. We good.
I also have a terrible ear, so I'm always happy when musicians I look up to say they can't figure stuff out. I am horrible at it.
I'm better at it now because of all the things that I've learned that I can kind of apply to, like, maybe that's, I have a much better time at guessing. But I'm even trying to figure out Fugazi stuff. If I can't hear the bass well, I'm like, I have no idea what I was playing, you know. So it's real. I'm just bad at hearing all those sounds at once, and I have a, my left ear rings pretty loud, people.
I will wrap it into beer by saying that one of the things I've learned from you is all the complicated ideas that sometimes you approach with a creative project. I've brought stuff to you, and we have sat and been like, all right, there's just too much stuff going on here at once. Then, but all these ideas could be spread across a bigger piece of music. And that's something that I think in beer for us, we, you know, we professionally make lager beer and ale that are like trying to have four things harmoniously work together, which is a lot of, takes a lot of inspiration from music, I think, because there's a lot of the same interactions. We're just in a different medium. Ooh. So that's as tied together as I can be.
Four people.
Four elements. That's all right.
The same thing. Band, a good beer.
It can be. Well, I appreciate you spending some time talking music and a little bit of beer with us.
Well,
and
thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Enjoy the day.
You too, guys. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Bye-bye.
See ya.